and addresses and lists of about people. And of those, only about a dozen would let me see my files. So in fact, what you're talking about reflects a very small slice of the information. I also included in there the information that Google and Facebook would let me see about myself, which I found was too revealing. And in the end, I decided to leave Google as a result, because I realized I didn't want to keep using their services when I was contributing to that much data storage about myself. And, you know, in the government realm, I really didn't get that much information about myself. I got one big packet from Customs and Border Patrol about my records of travel. And the FBI said they didn't have anything and couldn't confirm if I was on a watch list. But the files I got from Customs and Border Patrol were really shocking, because it turned out my employer, Wall Street Journal, was inadvertently sending internal communications that reporters would send to their bosses about the purpose of travel. You had to fill out a form sort of internally on our web portal that would say why you wanted to travel, and then your boss would approve it. And then those files, as part of the booking of the trip, would actually just be sent to the government. It was unbelievable. Anyways, once I let them know, they worked really hard. It took almost a year for them to change the system so that it wasn't automatically sent to the government. But, I mean, people just don't actually know where the data is going.
And so kind of turn that around as to how that might apply to somebody else, somebody listening to this program and their travel patterns.
Well, I mean, most people just don't, I think, realize how rich that data is about their travel. I was really surprised. I kind of thought it's sort of innocuous, you know, I'm traveling, you know, I'm used to the idea that you have to go through TSA, whatever. But the files that the government gets from your airline, actually, are really detailed. It talks about which seat you're sitting in and which kind of requests you've made for upgrades, and every sort of conversation you have with the person at the kiosk is basically recorded in there. I had this hilarious thing where my employer had put a marker in my travel plans, which I didn't know about, which said not VIP to alert people that I was not a very important person. So, like, that was sort of in my files as well.
And you mentioned in that answer, Julia, that you couldn't get much from the government about what they have collected about you, as compared to even the minuscule amount that we just listed of minuscule percentage of what the commercial sector accumulated on you. So how does anyone find out anything about what the government has collected about them?
Well, it's hard, because the government, first of all, you have to figure out where your data might be, and then go to those agencies like the Veterans Affairs or Health and Human Services, and then ask for your data under the Federal Privacy Act, which actually is supposed to give you access to your files. But there are so many exceptions and loopholes that there are a lot of people who have pursued lengthy litigation and not always been successful at getting their files.
I'm speaking with Julia Angwin. The title of her new book is Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. So you did decide to try to be less tracked, and you did various things. You mentioned that you left Google. What have been the challenges of that decision since you left Google?
Well, leaving Google was really hard, actually. I mean, quitting Google Search was actually one of the easier things I did, and even that wasn't that easy. I switched to a web search engine called DuckDuckGo, and basically they don't store any logs, so they're not keeping records of my searches, and they're not trying to identify me by location. And what is interesting about that is when I switched, I found it was really, I had gotten so lazy. You know, I was used to the fact that I start typing something and then Google kind of fills in the rest of the sentence for you. And so I realized that I had sort of lost my ability to search. I was so succumbing to this sort of temptation to let Google do the work for me. So I had to retrain myself how to use DuckDuckGo. And to be honest, I'm still not in love with their maps or their news. And so I still kind of end up going back to Google or Bing for occasional searches on those fronts. But even harder was leaving Gmail. I wanted a privacy-protecting search engine. You know, Gmail says that they read your email. I mean, their machines scan your email for keywords and place ads against it, and that's the opposite of privacy. So I wanted a privacy-protecting email service that was as good as Gmail, and to be honest, there aren't many out there. In fact, barely any. I found a very small startup email service that I could donate to, but it's not really open to the public. You have to be invited to join, and so it was not very successful.
RiseUp.net?
RiseUp.net, yes. I think it's actually based in your...
Yeah, in Seattle, I believe.
Right.
Maybe Washington.
And they're great. I love RiseUp.net, but, you know, they have a very small quota, so I have to constantly delete my emails. So it's not the most user-friendly experience.
Mm-hmm. And as a journalist, is what you're doing in that area, does it limit what you have access to? I guess Google search, giving up Google
search. Not so much, actually. To be honest, I've been really happy with the fact that I don't feel like I'm missing much. You know, I was worried when I started my switch off of Google that I was going to, like, suddenly be almost, like, blind. I wouldn't be able to see any information. But it turns out I'm fine, and even RiseUp.net is a great service, actually. It's just that it requires a lot more management by me. So I have to invest more time in sort of making sure I download my emails to my machine and delete them from their server so that I don't go over my quota. And, you know, but in the end, I've learned to adjust, and I'm able to function just almost the same.
Now, in an interview you did with Bill Moyers recently, he asked you about what people could do, what the average person could do, I think, some question like that. And mm-hmm. you talked about passwords, and you have a chapter on passwords in the book. What is the importance of passwords for the person who wants to limit their tracking, their being tracked?
The problem with passwords is mostly that there's just, even if you don't care about the government or commercial tracking, you should care about hackers, and they are getting really good at hacking people's passwords. And what they mostly do is take passwords that were hacked at some website and use them on a new website. So essentially, the problem is you really shouldn't ever use one password more than once. And that is a really difficult challenge because most of us have dozens of passwords. You know, I have, like, I think 70. And so the idea of having to make a new one for each website is really exhausting. So I recommend people use a password manager such as 1Password or LastPass or KeepPass. And basically, those will help generate random strings of numbers and letters for you, so you don't have to do the work yourself, and you will have better passwords as a result of it.
And you had your daughter involved in your password generation.
Yes. So in addition to using the password manager, I also needed a password for my password manager. I also wanted my Gmail and my bank account and my other emails to have passwords that weren't in the password manager, just because I felt, who knows if that manager might be hacked. So I had my daughter come up with a method where she would look up words in the dictionary for me. It's proven that if you pick really random words from the dictionary and put a bunch of them in a row, it's actually pretty hard to break that password. The problem is most of us are not that good at picking words randomly. We think we're being random, but we actually kind of pick words we like. So I had her use a numbered dictionary, roll dice, and pick the words based on the dice rolls. And she charges me $1 a password, and then actually has expanded to friends and family. She's got a little password business going on.
And it also helped you have an educational moment with her about privacy.
Yeah, it was great, actually, because prior to that, she had not cared about privacy. She thought that I was just a mean mom who wouldn't let her go on YouTube and make her own videos, and why wasn't I letting her do what she wanted online? And to her, privacy meant no. And so once I showed her how to do passwords, she thought, oh, privacy is actually kind of cool. I can make sure my brother doesn't break into my email account, and I can make some money. So she got interested in it, and then that led her to adopt more of privacy protecting measures. So she put on this blocking software that I use that blocks online ad tracking technology. She really loved it because it was like a little picture of a ghost It's called Ghostery, and it shows you how many trackers were on the page that were blocked. And to her, it was a video game. You know, how many could you block? Oh, I got to a website, Mom, with 40 trackers on it. It was so cool. <You know? laughs> So, and she's 9, you know, so it was like, it's been fun to watch how she's really started to be into privacy.
Mm-hmm. Now, tracking cell phones and cell phones in general, that's a huge area as far as privacy goes. Describe the most invasive aspect of having a cell phone and being vulnerable.
For me, I'm very worried about the fact that your location, where you are, is being transmitted all the time by your cell phone and is incredibly sensitive information. So these researchers found, for instance, that it takes only 4 unique location points to identify uniquely 95% of people. And that makes sense, right? Because there's really only me who goes to my office and my home and, you know, whatever 2 other places in between. And so the problem is so many people have access to that location data. It's not just your cell phone carrier. It's also many of the apps. And also there are more and more companies and retailers and shopping malls are using technology to identify your Wi-Fi signal as you walk by. And so they can find your location. And actually, the cell phone carriers have all gotten into the business of selling your location data unless you go into their long privacy policy and find the weird little opt-out. So it's becoming a new kind of commodity about us that can be bought and sold, our location, and that really bothers me.
And location, as you mentioned, you said it's very important. I think maybe in ways that people don't realize of just how sensitive that particular kind of information is.
Well, unfortunately, location data has, you know, been used to stalk people, and it's also can be used to predict your movements. You know, some researchers found that people basically, where you are every Wednesday is a pretty good prediction of where you will be the next Wednesday because people seem to be in the same location about a week later. And so it can be very predictive of your future movements. And, you know, I just don't particularly want, not even worrying about stalking, but just I don't know that I want the government or commercial entities to know where I'm going to be next Wednesday.
And what about social media? You opted out of aspects of social media.
Yeah, I quit LinkedIn. I deleted my account, which really caused me some heart palpitations because I worried that maybe one day I would never find a job again. But so far, hopefully, luckily, that hasn't happened. I unfriended everybody on Facebook. I felt like I couldn't leave Facebook. I wanted there to be something on Facebook that just says, hi, I'm here. I don't really come here, but come visit me on my website or on Twitter. So I left a sort of skeleton page there.
And what?
But the reason for both Facebook and LinkedIn was that my network of associations, like those places are all about your list of friends, right? It's about friending people or making connections, and then those lists of friends are viewable in many cases, and even if you try to lock them down, they can never become totally private. And to me, I just felt that as a journalist, I didn't want anyone to think that those are my sources or to unfairly cast suspicion on someone as maybe being a confidential source. But I also just felt that my network of associations is extremely sensitive information. I mean, we think we're really unique people, but in fact, we generally like the same movies and music and politics as our friends, and so they reveal a lot about us. So even if your page is not very revealing, who you're friends with is. And so ultimately, I decided there's no reason for me to give that information away.
You're still on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. I've decided that following people on Twitter doesn't imply the same level of friendship or connection that the LinkedIn and the Facebook friendings do.
And what about encryption and anonymizing software? How much do you use that, and how has it helped, and how has it been a problem?
I do use both anonymizing software and encryption fairly regularly. Neither of them are particularly easy to use, although the anonymizing software isn't so bad. I use something called Tor, and basically what it does is you download this free software, and then when you're browsing the web, it routes your traffic around the world. So I might be sitting here in New York, but it would look like I'm browsing the web from Amsterdam. The problem is I'm actually browsing the web from Amsterdam, so my traffic is pretty slow. So the problem with the anonymizing software is that you have to be willing to be traveling at slower speeds online, and sometimes I'm not willing to, but if it's something sensitive, then I am willing. With the encryption software, encryption is great, but there are a couple problems with it. One is both parties have to have it. So even if I download encryption software, you have to download it too, or else we can't send each other messages in secret code. And it's not particularly easy to use, and so I've had a struggle getting other people to use it. I do use it pretty regularly with people who are willing to use it, but I haven't, like my husband refuses to do it.
But you feel confident that it is helping you keep a lower profile, so to speak?
I'm not sure. You know, the thing that's weird about encryption in particular is that, like, the NSA documents showed that the NSA really views using encryption as suspicious. So, in fact, they may well be putting more scrutiny on me because of using PGP, which is this pretty good privacy encryption program, than not. But I've decided that, you know, I would really rather not let them scare me off of it. You know what I mean? I didn't want to feel scared away from using it just because they might think it's suspicious. I don't think that it should be suspicious to want to have confidential communications with people.
I'm speaking with Julia Angwin. The title of her book is Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. And at the end of, in the last chapter of your book, which is pretty harrowing, you do say that you are hopeful, which was interesting. And can you talk a little bit about that?
I know one of my reviewers said I was irrationally optimistic, which I think is probably true. But I feel like that's the only way to get anything done in the world is to be irrationally optimistic. I basically feel like we have a collective problem on our hands that we have of the kind that we've solved before. So after we got factories and mechanization at the turn of the century, you know, we really polluted our country with industrial waste. And after about 50 years, we realized that we didn't want to do that anymore, and we decided to address it. And it took a long time. We passed the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, but we also started recycling and picking up our dog poop. And so we changed our individual actions, and we also had collective actions that we took. And I think this is a very similar problem. Privacy is something that kind of pollutes our world. You know, the inability to have confidential conversations, for instance, is something that I worry sort of chills our freedom of speech and hurts our democracy. And so it's a collective harm, and I think we will solve it collectively, but we also will solve it by taking individual measures, you know, maybe using encryption like I use, or turning off tracking on our web browsers and installing software like that. So I think that we need to increase our own tech literacy and be more active citizens, but I also think we're going to end up probably trying to solve it through some collective action as well.
Yeah, and as far as that goes, you make quite a case for pushing for transparency. What are some of the things that could be done by people in that area?
One very simple thing is just to let people see their data and have it, right? I was so frustrated that these data brokers had files about me that they were buying and selling and had all this information about myself that they wouldn't even let me see, not to mention remove myself from their files. And so very simply, you know, we are the only Western nation that doesn't have a law that basically says commercial data gatherers have to provide individuals the right to see their data, correct it, and sometimes remove it. And the Obama administration proposed such a bill 2 years ago called the Privacy Bill of Rights, but it really hasn't gone anywhere. The industry thought it was too restrictive, and privacy advocates thought it was too weak, and so it didn't really gather any steam. But I have some hope that we will meet the international community at that at least baseline standard.
Mm-hmm. Now, he spoke today, I believe, on ending the NSA's practice of collecting records on millions of U.S. phone calls.
President Obama.
Yeah. I think it was today, but it says the program will continue as it is currently structured until Congress can pass his proposal or something similar. Do you have any thoughts on those?
Well, I've been really encouraged that the president wants to end the phone dragnet. You know, when it was first revealed by Edward Snowden last year, he defended it, and he defended it up until fairly recently. And it's an incredibly vast and sweeping dragnet. Every single call made by Americans and for seven straight years or longer, and not the contents, but the record of the time and when you called and who you called, and, you know, that can be as revealing or more revealing than the actual contents. I mean, nobody wants to listen to the contents of your call. If you call the abortion clinic six times, you don't need to know what it said, what was said. It's pretty obvious what's going on there. So I'm really encouraged that he wants to end the dragnet and has declared his willingness to do so. Now, whether Congress will act on it as quickly as possible, I can't predict.
And in our last couple minutes, Julia, I was just starting to read an article that came through the site Tom Dispatch that's called Are You Ready for Life Under Total Surveillance? And it's talking about estimates that by 2020 there could be over 30 billion devices connected to the internet, and they will have smartened up thanks to sensors and other technologies embedded in them, and et cetera, and our life will quite literally have gone online. How do we live or talk about the things that you're talking about in light of that possibility?
I mean, yeah, that is something that I live with every day, actually, because my husband is an engineer who loves sensors. So without telling me, he actually installed sensors in the walls of our house when we were remodeling, which monitor our heat and electrical usage and water. And I found out about it only because his grad students mentioned to me that we were using a lot of electricity on Fridays, and they wanted to know what was going on, because apparently they have a real-time readout of our usage in their lab. Mm-hmm. So I live with this every day. And, you know, the truth is I want to learn from my data, so I'm happy to know that the vacuum cleaner was using a lot of energy on Fridays. Actually, kind of, we changed our behavior. We learned that our toaster was really inefficient. But what we need is some assurances that the data won't be misused. You know, I see it like cars. You know, cars are really dangerous, but we get in them every day. And the reason is because we know they have met some sort of safety assurances. And if something goes wrong, we also can sue and we have legal rights. And so I think that if we could have some assurances about how our data would be used and some legal rights over that, then we would feel more comfortable in this world, and it will have some benefits.
So you're talking about maybe government regulation agencies or various regulations through government that would put some limits on what's happening?
I mean, it could be that we come up with these voluntary baseline standards, but I think most likely we would have to have them enforceable in some way by government.
Well, Julia Angwin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. This book has many, many issues that we could discuss at length. We just sort of gave an overview there. But thank you so much for being with us and talking about Dragnet Nation, your new book.
Thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you. And this has been A Deeper Look. I'm Kathleen Stevenson sitting in for Linda Olsen-Osterlund. Get well quick, Linda. And thanks to Rock for engineering. Stay tuned. Air Cascadia is off today, so stay tuned for Flashpoints.
Hey, good morning. You are listening to The Mighty Boo, KBOO Portland, just a minute before 10 o'clock. In 1 hour from now, at 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews author Helen Oyeyemi about her new novel, Boy, Snow, Bird. And at 11:30 on The Film Show, the guest star Vivian Haar, the 10-year-old anti-slavery activist at the heart of the documentary Stand With Me, and Student Academy Awards coordinator Thomas Phillipson and filmmaker Andy Chandler, who will be telling us about the upcoming Filmed by Bike Festival. But first, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll be going straight to Flashpoints, and that is coming up next on KBOO. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our in community radio. It is your community radio station, KBOO. If you are not a member, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to become one.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Flashpoints, 25 years after the Exxon Valdez oil tanker disaster. We'll speak to journalist Greg Palast about the special role BP Oil Company played in the disaster. Also, police in San Francisco's Mission District gunned down 28-year-old Alejandro Nieto, and the community is outraged. And we'll speak to the writer and the starring actor in Placas, The Most Dangerous Tattoo, about a former Salvadoran gang member trying to put his life back together. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavila Molina. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, this week represents the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez disaster, and it was perhaps the worst disaster in environmental history. An investigative reporter who has been on the scene and was there on the front lines is Greg Palast. Greg Palast is a best-selling author, a reporter for the BBC and Democracy Now. And Greg, welcome back to Flashpoints. I think it would be good if you paint us a picture of what happened 25 years ago on March 24th, 1989.
I'll paint you two pictures. First, there was the fairy tale story of what happened that's accepted, which is that a drunken skipper ran the Exxon Valdez tanker up on some rocks. It broke open and spilled 11 million gallons of oil, slathering and destroying 1,000 miles of Alaska shoreline. The destruction was real, probably more oil than reported. But it wasn't about a drunken skipper hitting a reef. That's a fairy tale. That's been promoted by the government and by Exxon, and I hate to say it, by my own team, because I was the chief investigator of fraud charges in the breakup of the Exxon Valdez. I was part of the team that won the jury verdict with that wonderful story about the poor Captain Hazelwood, who was drunk, so it was all about human error, and they shouldn't have let a drunk run a tanker, operate a big tanker. Now, here's the real story, Dennis, from inside. I investigated this 3 years full-time, inside out, with a giant team. And what we found was that Captain Hazelwood wasn't even in the helm. He was down below decks, sleeping off his snout with the first mate and the second mate. They were also sloshed. The third mate just didn't know how to operate. The ship ran it aground on the reef. But that's not the real disaster. And the real untold story, it's not that the third mate made a mistake. The problem was, and it wasn't Exxon, because even though Exxon name is on the ship, I don't want to let them off the hook, but the real culprit here is British Petroleum, BP. That's the real story that no one knows.
And before we get into that, given the fact that BP again has been given the go-ahead to work with the U.S. government just, this month. But just say a little bit more about what the damage was, what happened to that place, and a little bit about how that suffering was sustained over so many years based on denials and corporate greed.
Two things. Yeah, this month the Obama administration said that BP can return to drill in the Gulf after the Deepwater Horizon explosion and blowout. And, they're now good boys. They can drill in the Gulf. And, in fact, they were allowed to bid and won a tract right next to where the Deepwater Horizon went down. And that's stunning to me, because behind the Exxon Valdez spill and the Deepwater Horizon spill was BP's massive and continuing fraud. Up in Alaska, by the way, I was just up in Alaska with the great filmmaker Richard Raleigh for Channel 4 Television Britain. And we scooped up a bunch of oil about 50, 60 miles from where the Exxon Valdez struck at Night Island. And we had experts with us to make sure that the oil we were finding, the gunk all over the place. Go to gregpalace.com, you see a picture of me picking up the oil with my gloved hand. This stuff is toxic. 25 years later, this crap is all over the place.
This is the oil from that accident.
From the Exxon Valdez. It's still there. And this is very important. I mean, those seals that have returned are going blind again when there's a storm and the sheens come out. The birds are still dying. And the natives who live up there and try to live off the land can't because they can't eat those razor clams. They can't eat that stuff. You know, you don't eat a clam where your choice is leaded or unleaded. It's poison up there. And by the way, after we flew to Alaska and picked up the oil, we flew down to the Gulf Coast where the Obama administration, BP, have said, oh, nature's cleaned that up again. You know the theory that nature's kind of a happy toilet. You just poop into it, flush it, and it flushes everything away. No, I was down in the Gulf, and 4 years after the Deepwater Horizon explosion, you could find oil mats that are big as sofas. We have film of that, too. And so the damage continues. The destruction continues. And when you talk about cover-up, for example, the chairman of the Department of Biology at the University of Alaska, who is the world's leading oil spill expert, he has said he went with me on these trips. And he said, look, from our experience in Nigeria and elsewhere, we're going to see this oil in Alaska there another 40 years, and in the Gulf another 40, 50 years. It's still going to keep poisoning the land and the people. And where I was picking up oil out of the Gulf, by the way, off those beaches, they did still have BP cleanup crews, which go away on the weekend so people can come and picnic on top of the hydrocarbon. It's only about 7 inches below the picnickers. And that stuff is coming up. Their kids reach in, and they're licking their hands, and they're poisoning themselves. But it's beaches, by the way, for the poor at Gulfport in Mississippi and Louisiana. And believe me, it's not Miami Beach. When there was a spill near Malibu, they practically went over the place with Q-tips to clean off every bit of hydrate.